Shoes. Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and you are listening to the EMSO, Fair Recovery Library, and EMSW call today. I want to welcome everybody. It's the 25th of June, 2000. I'm going to get here in a second. 2014. So, thank you very much for joining the call. Let's get on to our questions today. First question. Married for Life, week 3 question. My husband and I have recently finished our EMSO series and are now engaged in the Married for Life weekly meetings. While I missed the facilitated group leader experience, I'm enjoying the opportunity to check in weekly with a community of couples who are focused on healing the trauma of infidelity. I'm wondering if you can give me some clarity about the assignment for week 3 in our series. It's the conclusion exercise. We imagine that we are leaving a testament of our life. We are to imagine we're leaving a testament for our life. My confusion comes because the exercise seems to have no context. I'm not certain why we're doing it. What is the wisdom we are to gain from documenting all the ideas, beliefs, and convictions? In week 1, you gave us an overview of Married for Life, and we completed the survey inquiring about being present and available to our partners. This week, week 2, you spoke about why we fight and introduced Dr. Sue Johnson's model of why we don't remain emotionally attached. The lesson ended with the 3 demon dialogues, and you mentioned that we'd be exploring them over the next few weeks. That was exciting to me as I've been reading the latest book, Love Sense. Her words and theories have been phenomenal support as I journey through the EMSO series. However, as I glanced at the lesson plan for week 3 is to do the conclusion exercise. In the past, I've done similar exercises to help generate gratitude for my life and to focus on the legacy I would like to leave. The kind of count your blessed experiencing rather than focusing on the negatives of who or what you've done wrong attitude, you can get the better of us. It can get the better of us at times. If you could share your intention of this exercise, I would greatly appreciate it. Well, maybe this thing is misstated, but the purpose of the conclusion exercise ultimately is to generate or to begin to generate a new lens between you and your mate, how you ultimately see each other. As a result of an affair, frequently we are devastated, more or less, and we don't see our mate in a positive sense. Everything that's happened affects the view with which we see each other. The conclusion exercise isn't about the things you learn about yourself individually. It's about listening to each other and beginning to develop a new lens for how you see one another, talking about things that are not affair-related, hopefully finding new understandings and new empathy for one another, or possibly even a new intimacy as you once again explore and discover the uniqueness of who you're married to. The reason I do that in week 3 is ultimately to create that sense of connection before we go farther into Sue Johnson's exercises. Again, it wasn't meant specifically for the two of you, or for you individually to do this and to develop more gratitude. It's really to develop a conversation and a new understanding of who you are, who you're married to. I will check the instructions and make sure that those are clear. If that's not, I apologize. But what I'd really like is for the two of you to be able to share that so that you can have a different type of dialogue and hopefully shift that lens through which you see each other. Married for Life, week 4 question. In week four, the only assignment this week is to record all of our disagreements and to try to identify which one of the demon dialogues is present in each quarrel. Then we're to share our findings with the group. There is a part of me that is screaming, this doesn't feel safe. Can you give our group some guidance that will create an atmosphere of safety and non-judgment during the discussion time? We're not experienced facilitators of group therapy, and we've observed a pattern within our community where we run a 2-to-4 ratio, 2 couples having challenges to 4 couples having a peaceful week. My concern with doing no harm to anyone having challenges in week 4. I desire a productive roundtable discussion where blame, rejection, guilt, and remorse get checked at the door. Can you say a few words that would create a container for us since the lesson is, again, in my opinion, without context? Thanks. Well, back to week 2, it's really not about the fights that we've had nearly as much as beginning to figure out the patterns that couples use. I mean, each couple will have a different pattern, whether it's find the bad guy, where we go into an escalating blame-blame cycle, the protest polka, the approach avoidance, or the freeze and flee, where we've disconnected. And whoever's been initially trying to engage the relationship now reengages. The hope was that by just looking at the quarrels, you could identify what the different patterns are. It's not about discussing the quarrels necessarily, but is looking at the patterns that are behind the quarrels, how we try to resolve things. Again, I will check instructions and make sure that that's clear, because it's not about – so if you're running at a 2-to-4 ratio, I would just hope that the 4 couples – and if nothing's happened, that's great. But even in a small conflict, being able to figure out what is the typical dance we do, if you can agree upon it, should be almost irrelevant to who's doing well and who's not. It may be more difficult, admittedly, the couples that are just that are really struggling. And yet, as we go through Sue Johnson's exercises, being able to find the patterns will have a lot to do with how you deal with those in the long run. Middle circle boundaries versus good practices. Hi, Rick. I'm the unfaithful spouse whose struggles over the years have been with pornography, inappropriate emotional affairs, and fantasy about sexual and emotional relationships with women. I've been fighting this for the past 5 years, going through a sexual addiction recovery program. It's been since full disclosure to my wife that I found the most success in overcoming the addiction. The EMS weekend has helped that process immensely. I've set a boundary for myself, inner and middle circle behaviors, when violated, are supported by my wife and accountability are reported to my wife and accountability partners. Where I'm confused is differentiating between boundaries and good steps to take to minimize the risk of violating a middle circle behavior. When I violate middle circle behaviors, my boundaries, it creates appropriate fear in my wife about my ability to remain faithful. And I want to have the middle circle behaviors as boundaries, but I don't want to create boundaries out of the good practices I take to minimize the risk of crossing my middle circle boundaries. For instance, one boundary is to not visually dwell on another woman, which leads to fantasy. A practice that I've put into place to help me with that is to do my best to pick a safe seat in a meeting where I have little line of sight exposure to women. That way, I minimize how hard I have to work to avoid looking at them during the meeting. Is this practice a good practice or a middle circle boundary? The concern I have with making it a boundary is that sometimes there are no great options, and I just have to minimize my risk by choosing to sit where I judge to be the safest for me. Another example, in work, dealing with women, I do my best to move to a more impersonal mode of communication. For instance, I try to handle requests by email rather than personal meetings, phone calls. Is this boundary to force everything to email or a good practice? It seems as this is more of a good practice, as there are many times I cannot avoid that there's more. It seems as this is more of a good practice, as there are other times when I cannot avoid a meeting or conversation to work an issue for a work issue. Last example, I maintain space around me during meetings to avoid close proximity to women. If it's an attractive woman, if an attractive woman sits next to me, I have a choice of creating more space and remaining where I am, or get up and move with an excuse like, I've got a crick in my neck, or this chair isn't working for me. Would getting up and moving be a good boundary or a good practice? Thank you for your help with this. So one of the things I want to start, let me go back to this one paragraph. I've set up boundaries for myself, inner and middle circles, that when violated are reported to my wife and accountability partners. Where I'm confused is differentiating between boundaries and good steps to minimize the risk of violating middle circle behaviors. Let me read that one. Between boundaries and good steps to minimize a violating of middle circle behaviors. So two things here. First, with middle circle and inner circle behaviors, I don't want those are two very different types of behaviors. If you're trying to set a boundary not to do middle circle behaviors, then that's not a middle circle item. The only things that you set, and I think you need to be careful about these, the only ones that are not optional are the inner circle behaviors. Middle circle behaviors are things that you're just not sure whether they're healthy or not. But there are certain bottom line behaviors that most definitely become not optional. Now, the boundaries that you live life with certainly are there to keep you safe. And hopefully they keep you certainly from high risk situations and prevent you from going down that relapse prevention field that I showed you during EMS, where you make these seemingly unimportant decisions that put you in high-risk situations unawares because of the seemingly unimportant decision, which then trigger old behaviors and set off the craving that then triggers the compulsion that then triggers losing control that then triggers the negative consequences. The boundaries are the things that we keep in place when we're in those high-risk situations that help keep us safe and to avoid bottom line behaviors. So I just want to clarify that to begin with, because I don't see boundaries necessarily as integrated with the three circles. I see boundaries as a way that we, a process we use to keep ourselves out of high risk situations where we won't go into old patterns. So the risk of violating middle circle behaviors, if it's middle circle, then there's not a risk. It's just things that you don't necessarily consider a good idea, or you're not sure if it's healthy or not, just a behavior. Now, or it can be even like watching television, or certain events. I mean, I don't know. Those may be middle circle behaviors, like football games, if you struggle with those things, going to football games. Now, and I'm not saying those in particular should be middle circle. Boundaries are just things you do ultimately to keep you safe, not to trigger the other thing. So with boundary violations, let's say you set a boundary where you don't want to be in have a meal, or you don't want to go one-to-one with someone. I think those are really valid one-to-one, like in a meeting. those are probably, if you can avoid it, those are good boundaries. Those things help keep you safe. And whether or not and how you want to report boundary violations, I guess, is up to you. I'm usually very careful about a wife being an accountability partner simply because I think in the long run, that's not a role they need to function in. I think you need to have another guy that can work with you. The disadvantage of your wife being an accountability partner in the long run is she's not a guy that struggles, temptations, things that you probably ought to be talking about will not ultimately make a lot of sense to her. Certainly the two of you need to discuss where or what types of violations need to be disclosed. Oftentimes I've got people that as long as their wives know they're checking in and they're doing their work, they basically make a list of the things where if there is a violation of like an inner circle behavior, one of their bottom line behaviors, or maybe if they come to the place of I'm trying to think of for instance, maybe looking at porn. I think it's going to be really difficult if you set a boundary not to see somebody or look at somebody. All you can do is honor the thing that you're trying to do, your commitment. Obviously, if you and your wife decide that if you fail to do that or you intentionally because to me, a lot of it is about intention. If you intentionally put yourself in a high-risk situation for something to happen, you can decide whether or not that's a violation. That can either be handled with your accountability partner, or you and your wife can decide that's something you would share. So you do want to maintain your boundaries, but again, I don't know if the boundaries are part of the three circles, and I don't know if that helps any. The three circles are just to lay out what's healthy, because you want to spend about 80% of your time there, what is absolutely not optional, and things that you really don't know whether you don't think they're healthy, but they're also not bottom line behaviors, and these you would probably want to minimize in the long run. But when you start looking about dissecting, disrobing, looking at women, that's part of the addiction pattern. Again, they're precursor, what we call almost lapse behaviors. But they may not necessarily be, they're things where the battle is fought, hopefully, but those boundaries are to help with those. That was probably as confusing as mud. If you have any questions next week, let's pick back up on that one. Last question. What is the difference between being supportive and being codependent? I'm trying to support my spouse in recovery from addiction. Please give an example of an appropriate way to show support. Thanks. So, being supportive with someone to me is far more about, I think, maybe encouraging, listening, but not being where you just hide your feelings, but also not even riding their emotional roller coaster. To me, codependency is about being so emotionally connected to your mate that you kind of flow with how they're doing. If they're doing well, then you're doing good. If they're not doing well, you're doing bad. Probably the best way to support somebody is by being able to maintain your own path and your own sanity in spite of kind of what they're struggling with, so that there's somebody that's grounded and hopefully they also aren't codependent and can stay in a grounded place when they're working and dealing with you. Without that, things tend to be, I've got two people spinning out of control. I think asking what maybe how they're doing is going to be important. When they do something well, telling them they've done something well. But being codependent would And enabling would be a type of thing where you're trying to be their motivation and trying to get them to do what they need to do in order for you to feel safe. That would definitely be a codependent move, not a supportive type of move. The supportive move would be, again, maybe applauding when they do something well, certainly pointing out if they do something, not letting them know if they've done something that really hurts you. Certainly being supportive isn't ignoring, again, those feelings. It's being able to speak up and then let them take responsibility for what they need to do about it. And hopefully your mate would do the same thing with you. Hope that answered that particular question. And that is all of our questions for the day. I want to thank everybody for being on the call. And I really do, guys, look forward to talking to you week after next, because I'll be gone next Monday. It's Labor Day. So everybody, I hope you have a good week, and I will talk to you then. Oh, I forgot to say to healing.